I think today you'd have to have a command of a larger spectrum of musical understanding from many, many different musical worlds than perhaps the music world was smaller long ago. And I think there's a far-reaching, broader expanse to musical knowledge, both being able to play in different contexts, whether it's world music, whether it's whatever the labels, you know, forget the labels, but whatever it is, I think you have to command a more of an understanding of just how wide your access to so much music is on an internet. I think you have to be aware of a lot more.
Hi, this is trumpeter and composer Dave Douglas, and this is the Greenleaf Music Podcast, A Noise from the Deep. That voice and music belongs to Jane Ira Bloom, saxophonist, composer, educator, and deep thinker about music and life. I was finally able to catch up to Jane in person last month. Jane's most recent album, Wild Lines, deals with the poetry of Emily Dickinson, and we heard Jane's piece, Emily and Her Atoms. We also talk about some of her earlier work, including the commission from NASA, which brought about art and aviation. Jane's music often explores the idea of movement in space and its effect on sound. You can find much of Jane's work at her label, Outline Records, available through her website, janeirabloom.com. And as always, write to me about this show at podcast@greenleafmusic.com. And support the show and all the projects at Greenleaf Music, all the artists, by becoming a subscriber and a supporter at greenleafmusic.com. Through the Bandcamp store, you'll be able to access the entire catalog. Please join us and enjoy this conversation with Jane Ira Bloom. Jane, thank you so much for joining me.
Happy to be here.
Wow, it's great to talk to you. Mm. I want to dive right in on the new record, Wild Lines, and just ask you about it from the perspective of something I've heard you say about project-based music. And so this is the project around Emily Dickinson and all of these pieces that you wrote being coming from this concept of the project. Is that... What was the initial idea for that?
There's always something that sparks my imagination. And I didn't even realize it maybe till a good bit later in my life that Emily Dickinson's poetry really gets to me.
Wow.
I don't understand it, and that's why I like it.
Huh.
And, you know, I knew many, you know, classical composers would write music based on her poems and set them to music, i.e. like tone poems. But I started learning about reading more of the radical historians who have found things about Emily that got me thinking more like an improviser. First of all, most people don't know that she was a musician. She was a pianist.
I didn't know that.
And she used, in the middle of the night, she used to go up, and her father recorded this, go up and make things up.
Wow.
Emily's making things up in the middle of the night. So she had music as a primary love.
Are there surviving recordings?
No. This is before.
Yeah.
Before the time of recording.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But it's documented that, wow, she loved music. She almost, yeah, she thought of being a musician even before poetry. So I thought of writing music from a different impulse, which was from the impulse of an improviser, kind of cross-talking from somebody else's, whose words, for me, feel like improvisational thought.
Wow. And I mean, I'm going to ask you about the Doppler effect later, which we just at the end of that excerpt, we hear some of that. But for now, when you say you don't understand her poetry, it's really interesting because I feel like the process of composition is very often this mysterious place that you don't really understand, mm-hmm, where you are. So do you feel like you bring the poems in some subliminal way when you...
Well, I think there's a more abstract relationship. For example, a lot of the pieces that are on that recording, the Wildlands, were stimulated sometimes not by feeling like I understood the meaning of a whole poem. Sometimes it would be a phrase. Mm. Sometimes it would be a stanza that just knocked me out.
Wow, I love that.
Or sometimes just a metaphor that said, wow! And even a phrase like Emily, please excuse Emily and her atoms. That just sends my imagination going. And so the pieces start from that premise.
Wow. And another interesting thing about the record is that you recorded, for lack of a better word, instrumental versions, and then you did a version where the poem was also read.
Yeah, it's kind of subtle. It's subtle. The pieces essentially remain the same, but the words have power. And when you hear them narrated by a great actor,
yeah,
Deborah Rush, somehow those words, they take on life like another member of the ensemble.
I was funny hearing you say that it was subtle, because to me, it changes everything.
Sure. Words are so powerful. Words. And this was the first time I've been, doing this stuff for a long time. It's the first time I ever did anything with words.
Wow.
With text and literature. It was my first experiment with it.
But do you feel like that changes the way that you, when you sit down to write? Like, I mean, I guess when you say project by project, that means that every time it's different, I would imagine.
Sure is, yeah. And I never know what's going to excite me, at what time,
Yeah, right. But at the same time, once you pick a theme for your project, there's a process that develops out of it.
I'm a lateral thinker, I think metaphorically, I guess, or I think visually in a musical way, too. So it all informs the choices I make, I guess.
Right. When you say lateral, you mean that all the fronts are moving together in a parallel fashion.
I think lateral. I think in different disciplinary ways. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When I see a dancer, I hear it. When I look at a painting, I feel it. When something I get from many different art forms.
From what people would call non-musical sources.
Yep.
Which I always take exception with that.
It's all music, yeah, right? Exactly. It's all music.
Exactly. So, all right, with that said, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were probably a saxophonist first and then developed into being a composer. At least that's the way I developed. Maybe it was the reverse for you.
I started playing piano when I was very, very young. And I also started playing saxophone when I was very young.
Yeah.
The piano was actually the first, but I was like 9 years old when I started to play saxophone.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's
it's been
great.
With me a long time.
So do you feel like this idea of seeing a dancer and hearing the music first developed out of your life as an instrumentalist? Or did that only come about later when you were sitting down to write music?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I have to think about that one. I think if we take the example of being influenced, for example, by movement and dance, I never, ever would have thought that I was interested in dance. But then when I was, in my early 20s, and I was around dancers and choreographers, they watched me when I played, and it was just intuitive that I moved when I played. And then it was from being associated with them that I learned that there was dance inside me. I didn't even know it.
Wow.
So it was a gradual process of how that even entered into my compositional process. And it was kind of organic. It wasn't...
Yeah. Maybe not separate from the playing then.
Maybe it is something that goes simultaneously.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're conscious, sometimes we're not.
That's definitely true. I've seen that before, choreographers looking at musicians play and developing things from seeing what I think for a lot of musicians are just unconscious movements. We're not thinking about it.
Right.
This is just happening.
Right. But that, sometimes the sound
together.
Sometimes the sound does come from the body, and whether it's feeling for rhythm or for whatever it is, it comes from the center of the body. Choreographers and dancers can always sense that.
It's interesting, but also to hear you say that, because you're somebody for whom movement has been such an important element of your playing.
Yeah, go feel. I didn't know. If you told me that from the start, I wouldn't have known that.
You mean you weren't doing that when you were 9 years old?
No.
Moving the horn around?
No, I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think so.
Well, so with that said, I want to play some of that same piece, Emily and Her Atoms, which I think... I don't know. It just feels very different. I love what you had the pianist Dawn Clement do behind the narration, which was part of this theme that you had, which I don't know if you say that it's in 11 or in 6 and 5, or I don't know how you were thinking about it.
I forget. I haven't got the chart in front of me.
Well, it's not. Maybe that's not that important, but I just thought that I'd play a little bit and just hear the difference and how wonderfully it comes across on this CD, Wild Lines.
Excuse Emily and Her Atoms. The North Star is of small fabric, but it implies much, yet presides.
Emily and Her Atoms, it's Dawn Clement on piano, Mark Helias on bass, Bobby Previtt on drums, and of course, Deborah Rush on voice, and it's composed by Jane Ira Bloom. And I wouldn't say we were arguing, but I had sort of, as I listened to it in preparation, well, first of all, there's the Doppler effect. We're going to get to that later, don't worry. But the it felt like a phrase of 6 and a phrase of 5, and then Jane was, you were telling me, you know, it was just written freely.
Probably that was my original impulse, and I haven't looked at the chart lately, but I have, maybe I broke it down. I can't remember.
Yeah, I just feel like it's really powerful to hear the words, and what you've written matches them in a really sort of eerie way.
It's unconscious, yeah. It's an unconscious relationship, I think. And like I said, words have such power next to music that... It's like another member of the band. There has to be room in the mind and in the spacing of your compositional thought for it. It's very, very important, and it has great power, I feel. Great power.
Wow. Yeah, that's really a great thought. And when I was writing more for dance, I used to feel the same way, that the dance was another member of the band for whom I had to leave space. Do you feel that in all of these? I mean, you've done projects for the paintings of Jackson Pollock and Freud's interpretation of dreams, and do you feel like you leave place at the table for Sigmund? When you...
Well, I wrote Freud's convertible.
Well, that's a slip.
Oh, well. There's always something that, some kind of crosstalk that's going on in my mind, whether conscious or unconscious, with these topics.
Yeah. Wow. Is this record, it's on Outline?
Yeah.
Wild Lines? So now that's your own label that you started in
1976.
Yeah. That's kind of amazing.
Yeah. On LP. We made LPs back then.
Right.
And back then there were just... it wasn't a choice. There was no new young musicians being recorded on any major labels. And so I was in New Haven at the time, and I was very influenced by people at the time who were doing their own music this way, like Leo Smith and Anthony Davis and Jerry Hemingway, all the folks.
Ray Anderson was probably there.
George,
Mark Dresser, maybe.
Mark Dresser, Mark Elias. Believe it or not, we were all in New Haven in the 70s.
Yeah.
And I realized that, well, I guess I better start my own record label too. And so I just learned by doing and started my first two recordings on my own label, which stimulated, you know, enough interest and recognition at the time that I was able to record for other labels.
Mm-hmm.
And then when all the record labels suddenly went away again, I just went back to recording back on Outline Records. So the last six or seven projects have all been, you know, just back on my own.
That's great. That's a lot of freedom in that, isn't there?
It's you know something, Dave? It's what I know. Mm. It's what I know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
I probably wouldn't be the kind of artist that would even know how to work with a producer. I've been so used to self-producing all these years.
Yeah, yeah.
It's what I know.
But art and aviation, that's a little bit earlier. Was that in the period when you were with Arabesque?
Yes, it was one of my first albums, I believe, for Arabesque Records. And it was just on the heels of this big project that I had done for NASA.
Yeah.
I was commissioned by NASA to be part of the NASA Art Program.
So if for listeners who may not know, NASA stands for National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
That's it, the one and only.
They sent the man to the moon.
And that's them.
They sent the two women spacewalking more recently.
Yeah, recently, yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of that music that's on Art and Aviation was...
Yeah.
Very much influenced by all these amazing experiences I had being part of this NASA art program.
Mm-hmm.
I was joining some visual artists.
I'm assuming that's not happening anymore, an art program at NASA?
No, I think it has faded away somewhat, yeah. I think so.
Yeah, wow, that is amazing. So this is like around the late 80s.
Yeah.
And NASA was interested in creating a liaison with various arts. I imagine, not just music.
Well, previously, the NASA Art Program was dedicated to inviting visual artists, painters, to experience close up firsthand what goes on with a mission. And they would give you special access to all the facilities at NASA, which amazing experience.
Mm.
And then traditionally, the visual artist would contribute a painting, which was part of NASA's traveling space art collection.
You mean they would put the paintings on the shuttles and
not the shuttles, but collection
Pioneer,
that used to travel around the country,
like Mars Rover maybe has a painting. Oh, around the country, okay.
Yeah, around the country, and you know they commissioned some pretty exciting artists. I mean Rauschenberg and some very interesting people, and as astronaut John Young said when I performed this piece that I wrote for NASA. I got the thrill of a lifetime meeting two of the astronauts. John Young was one of the men who walked on the moon.
Wow.
And he said in this introduction before the piece that no matter how many photographs you try to take of what I saw up there, you'll never see the amazing shades of gray that I perceived when I was there. We need artists to help you communicate to you what we saw. So here's the raison d'etre for why artists trying to help communicate the inexpressible to people. You
know? And this is the guy who was actually up there.
And he was there.
Wow. So you must have had a lot of meetings with people in the program about...
Different people. Those were the only two astronauts I actually met, but we met...
About engineering?
Yeah,
and
we went to all the facilities. Oh, my God. It was amazing.
Wow.
Down at...
Did they have you do, like, zero gravity simulations?
You know... I think I was offered a
you
trip, but
no
I don't think I could have handled it. The vomit comet, you mean?
Oh, is that what they call it? Yeah, I've never heard that. How charming!
Yeah, no, never made it on that one. But my imagination certainly went there because I was thinking all about it.
Remember when this was happening? I mean, I hadn't been in New York all that long, and it just seemed so amazing that improvised music was being created in this spirit, in this environment. And it was really important.
It's always fascinated me to think about, you know, what could a musical listening experience be like in zero gravity?
Yeah.
No more proscenium stage, I'd say.
No, probably not. And yeah, violinists and their bows, they'd have to be really careful not to get separated.
Yeah. And that's how I think my interest in surround sound came about, you know, thinking thoughts like that.
But you did electronics in the piece itself, too, didn't you?
Yeah, I still work with some very old analog effects processing electronics. Students come up to me and they say, oh, my God, where'd you get that? They're like antiques now.
Where'd you get that? I got it at Manny's.
Yeah, at Manny's in 1981.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? But they're old. The sounds that these particular boxes augment the saxophone sound with are more like, you know, the kind of analog electronic sounds you'd hear in like early sci-fi scores, you know, you know, Forbidden Planet, that kind of thing.
And you have a clip-on microphone on your soprano saxophone and run it through the boxes, or is it something different?
Not a clip-on, but just regular. I run a separate microphone.
I see.
Into each of the boxes that I'm using, and then I blend that with also miking the saxophone acoustically.
The natural sound, yeah.
So it's a blend. It's a blend.
Yeah. Well, you can hear that really well on this piece that you recommended that we listen to. And I guess it was part of the commissioned piece. So were you playing in planetariums or where were you?
Well, interestingly enough, yeah.
You did? Yeah.
Yeah, I played.
That must have been so amazing.
It was very cool. Although I have to admit, they are very dry environments.
Yeah.
But the fun part is getting the planetarium projectors to improvise with the star projections with us in the dark. That was something that was very cool.
Wow, I would think that would be illegal in some states.
Well, sometimes it got people dizzy, you know.
Right.
It got people dizzy.
Wow.
But
that is so great. And the band on the record was the same band that did these performances with you?
Yeah. That's,
you had Kenny Wheeler on trumpet and Ron Horton on some things.
Mm-hmm.
And Kenny Werner.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the two Kennys that you get to confuse the
last
name. And then Rufus Reed was on some, and Michael Formanek was on some, and Jerry Grinnelli was there,
right.
Which is
the NASA, the crew that joined me for much of the NASA music was drummer Jerry Grinnelli and bassist Rufus Reed. And we did perform many different places.
That's
doing
so
this
great.
Unusual music.
That seems perfect for Jerry, too. You know, he's just already out there.
Oh, absolutely. A fellow sonic surfer. No question about it.
Let me just play a little bit of this. It's called Most Distant Galaxy. It's from the record Art and Aviation. Jane Ira Bloom. Thank you. So you said you have a confession to make about those sounds at the very beginning of that piece?
Yeah. The people are going to laugh when they hear this this track that I made. But I was improvising on my old Yamaha DX7.
A classic.
And I think I recorded it on a cassette tape. Mm. And somehow we, with the help of Jim Anderson, we were able to make it sound good enough to have as the basis for this track. And then you'll hear myself and Rufus and Jerry playing spontaneously some live electronics on top of that.
Yeah. I mean, cassettes, there was a very saturated sound. And they're coming back. People have all cassette labels now.
Unbelievable.
You were ahead of your time.
I'm not going back to the LPs, though. I'm not going back.
So this idea of something you said in an interview I read somewhere about how you spent all this time playing with electronics on the saxophone and experimenting with all these sounds, and then you found yourself just with the instrument emulating the effects that you'd gotten from using the electronics.
Isn't that interesting? Have you ever spent some time working with electronics?
It happened to me, too. I just felt like, oh, yeah, exactly.
And then you start to play acoustically, and you don't realize it, but then you start imitating the electronic sounds.
What the pedals would do, yeah. Right. So, like, you've been working with this idea of sound moving through space, and then, of course, the Doppler effect, and but maybe beyond just the Doppler effect, the idea of what happens when sounds move and how the tone and timbre and even the pitch changes. And I'd imagine that was probably some of the things you were also looking for in interacting with electronics. Was that always a concern or?
It was always kind of an intriguing interest, yeah. And the electronics are there just to augment this real basic interest that's right there. It's in the acoustic sound. I think I can even hear myself swinging the horn around in one of my first recordings. Mm-hmm, I didn't even know what I was doing. Mm. But as years went on, I developed it.
But it has a lot to do with space and movement. Mm-hmm. And it seems like that's very conscious for you now, even though you may have stumbled on it early on.
Yeah. And thankfully, people I've worked with, as I mentioned, choreographers, helped me become more aware of it.
Interesting.
And certain contemporary music composers and thinking of sound being a more an experience that could be circular as opposed to linear. Like you could be surrounded by sound.
Yeah.
360. I started thinking about things like that.
Mm-hmm. You think that's why NASA came to you?
I came to them. That's how it happened.
Because you were thinking about space.
Yeah, I wrote them a letter in the dark.
Wow.
And that's how it all came about.
Huh, interesting. It sounds a little like what you're saying about the sound being all around you and the location of the sound being as much an element of the music making as anything else, melody, harmony, rhythm, timbre. It sounds very much like the composer Henry Brandt.
Yes, very, very early important influence.
Oh, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah.
Did you ever get to meet him? Or
No, but I studied his music
and listened
to it and was one of the primary contemporary composers who was interested in antiphonal sound and placing instruments in space. That's very interesting to me. That's a direction that some of my orchestral thinking went in when I was trying to augment some of these sounds that were part of my signature interests as a player and tried to start adapting them to orchestrating them for larger groups of instruments, brass instruments and woodwinds, and seeing how far I could go. Henry Brandt was absolutely an important influence.
And had a long life. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that long ago that he passed away, and he wrote just some spectacular and very surprising music. Mm. So when you studied the scores, were you looking at where he was placing things? And
oh, sure. He was placing different instruments in space in the halls. And, he was one of the primary originators.
One of the conductors that worked with him a lot that was in New Haven, maybe, or Connecticut somewhere?
I can't remember.
Because we did this trumpet festival that I've been doing for some years. Uh-huh. We produced a Henry Brandt piece one year, and it was for I think it was 52 trumpets and percussion. And
wow.
And it was great. And this conductor who had worked with Brandt told us, you know, you better get a bunch of extra trumpet players because some aren't going to show up. So in the performance, we ended up with 65 trumpet players.
Wow.
Because everybody showed up because everyone wanted to do it. And it was just a magical, we did it at Roulette, and we had, you know, different choirs of trumpeters in different parts of the balcony, and the sound was just moving all over the hall, and it was such
how
a spectacular,
how exciting,
such a difficult production to put together. You know, we were all, we sat down at the table after it was over, it was like, okay, never again. But
cool,
it's hard to mount that, and so maybe the fact that you can do it all by yourself on the saxophone simplifies things a little bit.
I remember years ago, it was like the early 90s, I wrote a piece that the American Composers Orchestra played, and we performed it in Carnegie Hall. And much to the credit of Dennis Russell Davies and the ACO, the trombonists and the French horn players, brave souls, I had them spaced up in the like third balcony of Carnegie Hall, which is, if you've ever been up there, it's precipitous.
Yeah.
And they were standing right on the edge of the balcony just to get this circular thing going.
Oh.
But they did it.
They didn't have fear of heights, I guess.
I bet some of them did, but they did it.
Wow.
It was kind of fun. It was definitely fun.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Was that recorded?
I doubt it. Maybe an archival something
might
have been made. It was a long time ago.
Incredible music. Mm-hmm. And speaking of surround sound, you won a Grammy for a surround sound recording, didn't you?
Yeah.
With this record, what Early Americans.
What a surprise. But I mean, my collaboration with audio engineer Jim Anderson.
Yeah, who you've been working with for many years, right?
We're like, you know, very close collaborators. Mm-hmm. And somehow the merging of the content of this music and his expertise at recording in surround sound made this a very extraordinary experience. I would never have guessed it. You know, just a jazz trio, sax, bass, drums.
Is it, who's on this? This one is Mark Elias and Bobby Previtt.
We are the trio. We've been playing for a very long time.
So great. So great. Early Americans, so we're talking Cotton Mather and Learned Hand, and I'm trying to think of early Americans, so maybe that's too early.
Whatever makes your imagination go.
You didn't have a specific project idea.
No, it's just an imaginative, it's just like the title of a poem.
I like it. But it's, I mean, if you're going in the studio to record surround sound, there must be some special planning that you're doing, or was it like, let's just play the way we play and let Jim do his magic with the surround sound?
Well, there's a lot to it, because Jim and I have been recording together, and his expertise has been at my side for many, many years, so there's a lot of stuff going on that album where I am moving around, and over the years we've developed a technique that he uses where he's got microphones around me that look like almost like a satellite system.
Okay.
That he's very, very aware of what I'm doing and accentuating that with his knowledge of microphone placement.
Well, and I imagine you go into that satellite space and you're now able to move around and you know which mic is which and where to go and what effect you're going to have.
It's a different kind of awareness, but it is still improvisatory. It's all improvisatory, though. It hasn't been really programmed or thought out. It's just everything is there ready to capture what needs to be captured, you know.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of Song Patrol from that record. Thank you. Song Patrol.
Oh my God. If you've never heard surround sound before, and if you're the musician who's making the sound, you've never heard a sound like this before, it's the most intoxicating thing to describe. And I've thought about it, trying to think, why is it, you know, as musicians, we're used to hearing the instruments in the relationship that we hear them in the middle of an ensemble, right?
But when essentially you stereo.
Right.
Two sides.
And you place them in space and you know where they are. What happens when you listen back in surround sound is that you are enveloped in a 360-degree experience. Essentially, there are times when you're hearing your insides coming at you from your outsides in a way that's so, the only word I can think of is intoxicating.
Wow. And you say you've heard this on some pretty
fancy,
amazing gear.
Thanks to Jim Anderson and Ulrika Schwartz, we've been guests of the PMC Speaker Company and Dolby Atmos Company. And in their pop-up studio, listening to this recording, I'll never forget, I brought Mark Helias up to listen to it for the first time. He knew the recording, but he'd never heard the surround sound before. And this is about as high-end audio as it gets in the world. I think Mark heard that bass introduction, and he nearly fell on the floor when he heard the sound of his bass coming back at him.
Wow.
It's a very powerful experience.
That is so great. So I want to hear one more track of this before we move on, but I wanted to ask you about this thing that I've heard you talk about, which is this idea of parameters in music, that being guided by the concept of maybe breaking down is the wrong thing, but analyzing the music in terms of smaller elements, atoms of what it's made of, and working from there.
Well, it must be the composer in me of thinking about the parameters of music and bringing things that I've learned about in the study, you know, in the study of composition, to bear on even thinking orchestrally for a small ensemble, or thinking about raising the importance of the level of timbre or sound in space, right at the same level that you're thinking of things like rhythm and harmony and melody, but giving fair share of thought and direction to those other parameters of musical sound. So that's the compositional part of me, I guess.
Yeah. I wonder, and I've spent time thinking about the same issues the same way, and I occasionally ask myself, well, what if I was really to try to separate these completely? This, but you mentioned timbre. If I had to sit down and write, not even an exercise, you know, sketch, thinking only about the element, the parameter of timbre, would that even be possible?
Well, as you probably experience this, the minute an improvising musician gives themselves a limit, that's just the energy you need to start something, and then to hell with it. then you do it, whatever you hear, you know. But somehow that stimulates a beginning thought.
Parameters come in handy in that way.
Yeah, it works for musicians often that way.
But it also feeds this project-based idea that you talk about, right? I'd imagine if you sit down with a Jackson Pollock painting, a whole other set of parameters come out of that.
I'm interested in keeping myself interested and surprising my own ears.
And your band.
That too. Like,
do you ever feel like you give the band some parameters and then they do something where it's like, that's not exactly what I meant?
That's when, as I've gotten to be a more mature musician, where I've learned that some of the best stuff happens.
so you'd be more inclined to just accept it and go, okay, that's not what I meant, but that sure is great.
Always keeping an open mind,
yeah.
Because when you work with great collaborators whose maturity as improvisational thinkers and compositional thinkers is vast, that what they bring to the table is not reading a chart.
right.
So I've learned to respect that over the years and work with it and
but even
collaborate
as you said,
it.
You know, you give the slightest limitation to an improviser and that's enough to get them started and then throw away the rule book. which I appreciate a lot, both as a player and as a composer. But I also sometimes feel like, especially, you know, writing in specific project terms, you know, if I have a theme and I'm trying to capture, and I give a lot of thought to what those parameters are I'm going to deal with, and then I give it to the band, sometimes I feel like, before we throw away the rule book, let's define what this thing is in a satisfactory way that works for everyone, and then we can...
Well, casting is everything. You know who you're writing for, and what they will give, what compositional thought they'll give to your thought, you know, I'm sure.
Fair enough. That's a really good point.
I mean, you can't do that with everybody.
Well, it's... Yeah, and a lot of times you're writing for people you may not know that well. Mm-hmm. Or if it's an orchestra, you may not know them
at
all.
Right, no, and the param, you know, the notation has to be specific and the communication has to be strong. You're right, yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes it can be hard to nail down those parameters, mm-hmm. like you said. But then every composer has a different level of specificity that they bring
absolutely.
To the table.
Absolutely.
And some people will show up with a blank piece of paper and say, okay, this is my score.
Yeah. I've been finding, looking at a life's journey, you know, in writing improvisational music, you know, for improvisers. As the years have gone by, I go in and out of times when I'm thinking in more complex musical terms, and recently I've noticed that I'm finding that I'm making my musical choices even more and more spare. I don't know what that means, or whether it's maybe that's going to shift and change, but that seems to be going on in my thinking at the moment.
Is it that you're throwing things out, or that you feel like you just don't need more things?
I think it has to do with a patience with negative space that comes with time and the power of it next to the things that you do choose to write. And not how many notes you write, but have you found the right ones? I'm the kind of composer, my husband will tell you, I will agonize for days over a note or notes in a particular phrase or something like that. It's just the way my mind works. And I suppose the poet, when you look at poets,
right.
you know, scratches, how many words they crossed off until they got the one that they wanted. It's a very interesting part of process. But there's a part of me that's like that too.
But it's also like decay. When you say negative space, how a note ends being just as important as how it starts.
Right, and how filled with energy the space is that you leave after a note or notes, and how much can your mind take in, you know? It's not always loud, fast, and high, you know?
Well, and also that negative space is not necessarily silence either.
No.
Even when you might not be hearing anything, you're still hearing the resonance of what came before.
That's right. That's right. And this is what composers do, and play with your sense of expectation and manipulate it in a way. It's very
But I'd imagine that, I mean, that seems, you know, when people talk about Miles Davis, you know, oh, he left so much space and he was so cool. And I always feel like it's this thing that we're talking about. It is not leaving, it's negative space.
No.
And I'd imagine that he was probably as much of an influence on you as he has been on me.
He was indeed, and he was a space carver. He's a sculptor, no question about it.
Interesting. Okay, before we get any deeper.
Okay, go ahead.
Big Bill, is it a dedication?
I don't know what it is.
So how'd you come up with the title?
It's just
like a poem.
I don't know.
So this is another one from early Americans. So if you're listening in podcast land and you have a surround sound system available, you should switch to that now. This is Big Bill.
Thank you.
big bill.
There it is.
You call it a crowd pleaser.
It's a funny little tune, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. And I'd imagine in surround sound, all those drums, bass, saxophone, you're moving around.
No question about it.
It must be really powerful. I know that one thing you do very effectively and powerfully, and you've done a long time, is being an educator, sharing with young musicians. Mm-hmm. And probably not just at the New School Jazz, but all over the world. Is there anything that you feel is like a 21st century musical skill that you feel young musicians need to learn, that you've encountered in your years influencing musicians and being an educator?
Well, that's a big question. You know, the one thing I take with me, being close to some of the great musicians who are the primary originators of the music that we play, being next to, you know, Ed Blackwell and Charlie Hayden and Fred Hopkins, and I think the thing that I got from them, and I felt so good about knowing them, was it's not always about what you play, it's why you play. And that's what I try to communicate to young people. Why you make the sounds that you do. Why it's got to come from the inside. I think that maybe is the most important thing that I tried to share with them, vis-a-vis my experience of being near those musicians and the music that they made, was why you play.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it goes to the being yourself idea, you know, the old find your voice thing that we always come up against in jazz.
Authenticity. There's no choice about it. There's no choice about authenticity. Be yourself.
Yeah. Right. But in the classroom, asking someone why they do it can be fraught.
Well, it takes a journey to learn about that and figure out what's important to you.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, that's a great and huge answer to a huge question, and maybe a not so great, but a big question. On the more specific level, I mean, I find myself asking this the more I work with young musicians, is just what are the skills that you need to have to enter the field now that maybe you wouldn't have needed to have 20 or 30, 40 years ago?
Oh, wow. I think today you'd have to have a command of a larger spectrum of musical understanding from many, many different musical worlds than perhaps the music world was smaller long ago. And I think there's a far-reaching, broader expanse to musical knowledge, both being able to play in different contexts, whether it's world music, whether it's whatever the labels, you know, forget the labels, but whatever it is, I think you have to command a more of an understanding of just how wide your access to so much music is on an internet. I think you have to be aware of a lot more. How you adapt that, I don't know, but the awareness of it, I think, has to be grand to match what is the new reality.
It's really hard because ears. As every decade goes by and we keep adding to the repertoire of the music, it becomes more and more huge.
It's overwhelming.
To be able to have that broad vision.
Yeah. Well, there's a part of me that embraces this macro understanding of the music world, and then there's the specificity that you need to be a great musician, which is to focus on what it is you do. So it's,
yeah,
like it's
yeah.
both those things are going on at the same time, in a way.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, another great answer. Mm-hmm. It's so amazing. I was even thinking, even on a way more basic level, you know, just the idea of having to improvise with no chord changes, or having to improvise at all, for one thing, since now classical and jazz musicians are being all mixed up together. Mm-hmm. But also, beyond improvising and being yourself and asking why, they still have to figure out how to play in tune. And I think that what that means is even different now.
Interesting.
Because there's such a more nuanced awareness of what intonation is and can be.
Well, and different tuning systems around the world.
Different tuning yeah. systems, but and, even within the expressivity of music and coming out of our own country.
It's true. It's true. Different musics require less specificity of the old idea of, you know, A440, that's for sure.
Right. 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 Or like different awarenesses of rhythm, different expressions of things you might be expected to be able to assimilate and play. Mm-hmm. And I just say that, you know, having been out there as you have in the world, being confronted by things that people hand me, mm-hmm. and I have to go learn a whole new layer of stuff.
Yeah, it's almost like a new vocabulary, yeah.
So in a way, I guess maybe it's the ability to identify and quickly learn when confronted with something that's an area of knowledge that you don't know.
Yeah, and not be afraid.
And not be afraid. And maybe afraid. That's the most difficult right. thing that they have to, because that, like you said, with the internet, you know, now everything is at our fingertips.
For sure.
So to be able to say, oh my gosh, here's this new thing, and I can see that this is great, and I love it, but I don't know what it is. I don't understand
it. Yeah, no, be fearless. Be fearless. You know, often we tend to be frightened of things that we don't understand right away.
Mm-hmm.
I can mm-hmm. remember, you know, Ed Blackwell telling me the stories about people, you know, other musicians coming up to him and, you know, what are you doing playing with that guy or Ned Coleman, you know? And Ed just said, I like him. History bored him out. But often people are frightened of what they don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as you keep an open mind and as long as you're receptive and you keep your curiosity about you, you can't go wrong. You can always learn, you know.
I love that. Mm-hmm. I think that gets to it. So Jane, thank you so much for talking to me.
It's a pleasure. So this is a great. Real special occasion to be able to talk with another musician intimately about all these concepts.
Well, things. The music is so fantastic, and I know you must have new projects coming along. Is there anything you want to tease?
Well, I'm still, you know, immersed in the world of immersive audio, so surround sound is still very much an interest of mine, and
uh-huh.
I've gotten inspired by this really fascinating woman, a black and white photographer from the 50s, 60s, named Bernice Abbott.
Mm-hmm.
Who's done some beautiful abstract physics photos that have now been inspired. I've been writing things inspired by these photographs. So I think this is the next project coming. And I
Great.
Think surround sound will have a part of it.
Oh, that is wonderful. I will look forward to hearing that.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
My
it's
pleasure.
Been great talking to you, Jane. Thanks. Oh, we're going out with Big Bill, but this is the version with narration
okay.
from the record Wild Lines.
From me, but leave me ecstasy, and I am richer than It's a joy to be with you, because near, I love you. Good night.
Hey, this is Dave. Thanks for listening to the Greenleaf Music Podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Send me an email. Talk to you soon.